This meeting is now being recorded.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Robin. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GPLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 3 String Contention Objections and Disputes Call on the 30th of January, 2018. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call. I would also like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for recording purposes. And if you would please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn the meeting over to Robin Groves.
Thanks very much. And thank you all for coming today. I know there's a lot happening this week, conferences and GNSO and intersessionals and board activities, and so I do appreciate folks taking the time to join this call, particularly this week. Let me quickly review the agenda if anyone has any questions or clarifications or want to revise anything, please do speak up. Okay, so first we will have updates on statement of interest and then the plenary co-chair, and then we will jump into the meat of our discussion today. We need to be coalescing our views, beginning to come to some kind of consensus here on objections. And in particular, we've got three different objections that we need to talk about: the limited public interest objection, the community objections, and the independent objector process. And then we will discuss the applicant freedom of expression and what changes do we think need to be made in that policy, in the new GTLD policy to implement those policy goals. Then we've got AOB, our next meeting in about 2 weeks, and that's about it. So does anyone have any questions or comments on this? Okay, not seeing or hearing any. Let's move forward. Does anyone have a statement of interest that they would like to update, your SOI? Now would be a good time for that. Okay, not seeing or hearing anyone, let's move forward to the next item, the plenary co-chair update. And I believe on today's call we've got Cheryl Lang-Denor, who's prepared to give us an update on what's happening with the overall plenary of new subsequent procedures. Cheryl, over to you.
Thanks, Robin. Cheryl, for the record, and just like many of you, as Robert noted, is very busy, otherwise occupied with a meeting and one other meeting and activities and demands that's going on this week. And because of that, this week's planned plenary call, which was going to be in the next few hours, I believe, has been postponed. And the next plenary call is tentatively scheduled, calendar invitations will come out when it's confirmed, for the 6th of February at, I think, 0300 UTC. So you might want to just lightly pencil that in until it's confirmed. However, in the absence of our plenary meeting, it doesn't mean that things have stopped happening. And I wanted to remind everybody that your leadership team, including, of course, the hard-working team from WorkTrack 3, have been meeting regularly since the beginning of the calendar year. We've had a couple of the work team meetings obviously going on. Work is continuing, and one thing that Jeff and I attended, it was a leadership team meeting between our PDP process and the RPM group, which is an important touching base exercise to see where we are in terms of our own individual timelines and where any crossover or nexus may occur. And main upshot of that, other than us working out that we're not too badly out of sync at all and that we will probably end up finishing in fairly complementary time pattern for the things that are essential for us in our PDP at least. So their phase one work, for those of you who are interested in that, is that we will be, in fact, catching up and meeting even more regularly as we come towards the close of our activities so that we can keep a closer eye on that timeline. Regarding the next plenary meeting, we will be continuing on the topics that we started at our last meeting, which means, of course, anyone who hasn't thought about their homework assignment is sending us some test cases that we can use for our predictability framework. There's still time. Please feel free to do so. And with that, you've got a packed agenda, so I won't take up any more time, and I'll give it back to Robin.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Cheryl? Things happening at the plenary level? Okay, don't see or hear anyone. So let's just move forward with our agenda. And let's go right into continuing our discussion on objections. And we're right at the part of the PDP now where we are coalescing our viewpoints and really getting ready to put them to pen to paper in a final report. So this is an important time to make sure to have your views in the record. So the first specific objection that we were going to discuss today is the what's called the limited public interest objection. And this was something that came about in the last round as a result of particularly governments, but not only governments, saying, well, what about morality and public order? How do we make sure we protect that on the Internet in the new GTLD space? And so what happened was Recommendation 6, it came out of that process, and the limited public interest objection came out of Recommendation 6. So that's sort of a very high-level background on what this particular objection relates to and how it got there. Let me just go into the slides here. And one of the viewpoints that seems to be coalescing, and this is your chance to say otherwise if this isn't the case, is that initial discussions have indicated that the existing policy recommendation and the AGB language remain in good order, functioning as envisioned, and are within scope and will be sufficient. So let me just stop right there and see what kind of feedback we can get on that initial reaction coming out of the group here. Do folks agree with this, disagree with this? Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Please, Anne, go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Robin and Anne, for the transcript, and I agree with this. I don't know if we might want to mention in the AGB reference to the human rights commitment, because I think that one of the limited public interest objection categories that was referred to was about human rights, and so it's just more of a question about updating than anything else, cross-referencing. So I don't know if folks want to cross-reference to that commitment ultimately or not, or even the stage of the commitment. It's a bit of, I'm not sure exactly where we are on all the accountability language, but I guess you see the question I'm raising about cross-referencing.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. I think that's a good point that since we did the new GTLD round, subsequent work has been done with respect to human rights and freedom of expression, that sort of thing, and in particular on that accountable workstream, workstream 2 group. And I know you're right there that we need to cross-reference that the framework and make sure that gets put into the discussion here. Anyone else want to weigh in on this? Okay, I see there's a question in the chat from Christina Rosette. She says, what is the specific work that's being referenced here? Okay, so what we're talking about here is the limited public interest objection. And in particular, after we've had a few discussions about this over the last year or two, and, you know, so we're trying to coalesce specific views on that. And I'm sorry. I see you say sorry meant the human rights work. Yeah, I think there that we just want to make sure that whatever we do on these issues, not only the limited public interest objection, but all of them, aren't in conflict with the human rights work that's being done in Workstream 2. I think that's what Anne meant, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Anne, or if anyone else would like to weigh in on this issue, or the overall general position that is being put forward about the initial discussion saying that the policy recommendations from the last round with respect to limited public interest or LPI are a good basis for going forward in the future. So if you disagree with that, please do speak up and tell us why. Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Please, Anne.
Yes, thanks, Robin and Sam. Just kind of as a further explanation, there was a lot of work done within the human rights subgroup relating to what it's appropriate for ICOM to be undertaking and what's a little bit, you know, outside its mission and scope. And in fact, a couple of governments participated pretty actively, and there was some compromise language worked out as to what ICANN, the organization, should or should not be doing. And I think that a lot of that work that was done could also, you know, inform this limited public interest objection, because, you know, you wouldn't want to see you'd want to see an agreement between, you know, the policy that is forthcoming ultimately out of the accountability mechanism with how this objection process might work. And so it's about the scope of, you know, human rights objection, I guess, so that there's a consistency between the two. And I note that Christina's saying, you know, she's not sure about the scope of that work and take a deeper dive into it. And I think that makes perfect sense, because the work that went to the accountability plenary, that there were statements, I think in Workstream 1, the commitment itself was finalized, and then there was further work in Workstream 2 that went to the accountability plenary, and I'm not sure of, you know, what stage that's all in, but it just seems that these things need to be consistent. Thanks.
Thanks, Anne. I see Cheryl's got her hand up. Please, Cheryl.
Thanks, Robin. Cheryl, for the record. So what I'm hearing here, and as someone who spent way too much of their lives in Workstream 1 and Workstream 2 on accountability, I'm delighted to hear this conversation being going on, is that there's a desire to ensure that any of your recommendations in this work track are clearly looking at any harmonisation and effects that may be needed to be recognised as a result of the Workstream 1 and specifically Workstream 2, human rights and other, because there may be other topics. So that's something that we could perhaps look at putting together a fairly simple tabular checklist, you know, what's there now in the AGB at Rec 6, and then, you know, annotate where there's a link to the work that's been done after that. Perhaps that's an action item you might want to consider.
Yeah, thanks very much, Cheryl. And I see in the chat, Christina also points out, she says, I'm not sufficiently familiar with that work to have an informed opinion. I'd like to take a deeper dive on that work and understand its current formal status before agreeing or not. So I'd prefer have until next meeting for others who may be in the same position that I am. Yeah, I think that's totally fair, and we'll have a much deeper dive in that work. I think it was sort of going to come under the accountability mechanisms discussion or the free expression discussion, but it does apply to all of these issues. And so I'll go back and talk with the other leaders and also with the leaders in the Human Rights Working Group and the CCWG Accountability and see what we can do to try to get some cross understanding between the two groups of how our work relates to each other. Does anyone else have any thoughts on that? Okay, well, I don't see or hear anyone. So let's go on to the next point on the slide. It has to do with standing. Regarding standing, concerns were expressed related to the fact that ALAC may have financial support to file a limited public interest objection, but may then be unable to meet standing requirements, and this seems to be inconsistent. And then, of course, in contrast to that, others have argued for no such financial support in the future for limited public interest and community objections going to groups. Do we have any views on this issue? This is another issue that's come up in our previous discussions, and so now let's try to come to some Okay, I see Alan's got his hand up. Please, Alan, go ahead.
Thank you. 2 points. First of all, there was a misunderstanding or misremembering. The ALAC did file several objections. They were not refused because of lack of standing. They were, and it's not 100% clear if they had gone farther, if standing would have been an issue. The judgments, to some extent, admitted that since the ALAC had the right to file, then they did have standing, but they didn't really address that question. The objection was refused based on essentially lack of cause, and you know, be that as it may, that is the way it turned out. The original concept of the ALAC filing such requests was that there was no other body other than perhaps the independent objector who could act in that sense on for public interest, and you know, the case was made at that time, and unless there is a case that could strongly be made against it, then I see no reason to change it. Like everything else we're doing, the essentially the applicant guidebook implementation should be standing unless there is a strong case made against it. And although the issue has been raised for the particular objections that were raised, the one of the main reasons that was cited why we shouldn't do it is is the ALAC was subjected to pressure and simply gave in to someone who was, you know, annoying them or who was pressuring them. And since I was heavily involved in that process, I can certainly say that was not the case. That may have been a perception, but it certainly was not the case. So I would assume that this will continue to be a part of the process unless we can come up with a decided reason why it should be changed. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. Does anyone else want to weigh in on this issue, financial support for LPI objections or standing to file objections in the first place? Okay, well, I'm only hearing silence. So I think we can move on to the next point on the slide. The work team discussed the possibility of reconsidering the concept, intent, and scope of the quick look mechanism, noting that improving the quick look could reduce objections, reaching the more costly and timely stages of the process. There was particularly concern about frivolous objections and trying to find ways to weed those out of the process in the future. Did anyone have any comments on this point? Any suggestions for how we could change or reform the existing implementation guidelines to try to address the frivolous objections with a quick look process? Okay, I see Alan's got his hand up. Please, Alan, go ahead.
It's more of a question than a comment. The wording here says that maybe we could, to rephrase it, maybe we could improve the quick look mechanism to reduce frivolous objections reaching a more costly stage. And the question I have is how? Are there suggestions on how we might change it to make it better and reduce frivolous objections going to a farther stage? I'm not an expert on this area, but I don't recall specific improvements that have been mentioned.
Indeed, that is the question of the moment, Alan. So if people do have suggestions for the how part of this, please, now is a great time because, you know, we're coming into the drafting of the report bit where we need to be providing specific guidance. And so the more specific guidance we can provide, in particular with the how, I think would be really welcome. Yes, Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that if we don't have any here, since it was raised and phrased like this, it would be fair game to put that question into the initial report and ask the community for, you know, if indeed there are ways to do this, can someone suggest them?
Great. Thanks so much for that. Okay, so that were the points that I had in the slide for today with respect to the limited public interest objections. And so does anyone else want to weigh in on limited public interest objections? Feel strongly one way or the other about some of the things we've talked about today or in the past on this point, the limited public interest objection? If not, I think we can move on to the next set of objections, which are the community applications and objections to community applications. So if you want to go to the slide on that, I think it's slide number 5. Thus far, we have spent a good bit of time on this issue, in part because there's a lot of diversity of viewpoints regarding this issue. But one of the things that I think we can say there is some agreement on is that we do need to come up with a definition for how community is defined. And so now I think the point really is, okay, how do we do that? Should there be subtypes of communities? Should they be organized by applicant type, organized by intended use of the TLD? An alternative to creating categories before the round would be to create a process or for giving contractual conditions, depending on the purpose of the application, rather than the identity of the applicant. Should communities receive priority or other differential treatment? What are the privileges that one gets if one is designated a community in the TLD process? And prioritized, what process should be used for prioritization? And if prioritized, what criteria and scoring thresholds should be used for prioritization? So we've got some real meaty questions here, but they are coming out of the discussions that we've had up until now in this working group. So we are making some progress, and we need to put a little more meat on the bones, if you will, on how we can do some of these things. Okay, I see we've got a queue forming here. First, we've got Alan and then Jamie. Please, Alan, go ahead.
Thank you, Alan Greenberg. Just a very quick, I see the suggestion or question. Do we really want to try to define community, or do we really want to ask how should communities be recognized? In other words, what are characteristics of communities? That may be a more flexible way of approaching it than looking for definitions. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Jamie, please, you have the floor.
Thanks, Jamie Baxter, for the record. Quick question. Are we talking about the community objection process here, or are we talking just about
objections in
general? Because I don't think these points really line up with the issues we've talked about as far as community objection, unless I'm completely missing something. These, I understand, are concerns that have been raised about community applications in general. But I don't see these necessarily being specific to the community objection process.
Well, I think it ties in because one of the objections that is created is for somebody to say, to object to somebody else's claim of being a community. So if there is opposition to a community application from a, I don't remember the exact wording, a significant portion of a community, then you can file an objection. And so these objections are all sort of based upon the idea of, you know, what is a community and how, what should a community be? Because that's what a lot of these objections that are questioning the validity of a community. So I hope that sort of makes sense how the two tie together.
Yes, Jamie, once again, thanks for framing that. That's helpful. I do see a number of things that are missing from this list. I hope this isn't the exhaustive list, however.
No, please. This is a great time to add to the list, delete the list, edit, cross off. This is exactly what this meeting is for, so please go.
Okay. Well, I'll add them now. Jamie, again, for the record. We talked about this to a rather large extent, related again to standing. And why is there not some sort of a pretest for standing instead of dragging the applicant into the full-on objection process when it's clear from the beginning and what evidence has been shown that the objector actually doesn't have any standing at all? The other issue that I think is important to discuss here as well is the training that goes into the objecting panelist. The ones reviewing it, and I believe a number of times we've cited the situation where the panelists in our case made a decision based on something they assumed would happen later on in the process, for us to only find out that later on in the process what the objecting, the panelists in the objection said didn't have any merit anywhere else in the process. So the training needs to be that the objector, if they think that there's harm somewhere, they need to rule on it right then and there and not expect that somebody else is going to fix the problem for them later on.
Thanks, Jamie. That's really helpful feedback. Some of the other points that are on the slide have to do with some of the implementation concerns that should be addressed in the next round. Assuming they're around, the lack of transparent predictability, the panel misinterpreted applications, panel improperly applied the CPE criteria, excessively high scoring threshold in the AGB, high number of reconsideration requests, the cost of the applications, the time to assess applications, the conflicts of interest among the panelists. The evaluation procedures for the applications were developed after the 2012 application window opened. There was a restrictive word count on community applications. There was lack of clarifying questions or opportunity for dialogue in the CPE process. So we do have some concrete proposals here for specific details that could be fixed to improve this process. So feedback on these, again, would be very helpful, additions, deletions, edits. Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Please, Anne, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. It's Anne. I think Jamie's point is well taken about a possible need to distinguish between the discussions on community applicants and community objection in that, you know, you could even have, of course, a community objection to a community applicant, and then you have this question of substantial opposition exists from a significant portion of the community that the TLD string targets. And so, and I think that relates to the whole question of how panelists get trained as well. So when you're looking at that community objection, there is that one element that you're not looking at as closely in a community application, which is whether or not a significant portion of the community is in substantial opposition and you know, how to get consistent decisions on that. So that differs, I think, as between the community application and the community objection. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else want to speak up on community objections, that process, improvements? Tahani, yes, please, go ahead.
Thank you very much. This is Tijani. Another example of community objection to community application. Let's take, for example, .NET. It could be applied for from the community, and you may have an objection from the Mediterranean community objecting. So it is, you can have another community object to the community application. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Prioritization among communities. Once, you know, if you've got two groups established and they're both communities under the rules, how do you decide between them? Okay, I see Jamie's got his hand up. Please, Jamie, go.
Thanks, Jamie, back for the record. If we're following sort of the process we did through limited public interest, where the end of the discussion was, well, what could we do to fix this? If we're looking for recommendations here, I'm happy to offer some suggestions for how to address the issue of standing with respect to community application. Because as I noted, the standing was not determined until the objection was in full swing, which meant the applicant was required to pay for it. Whereas it feels like frivolous objections should be weeded out before anybody has to do any extra work. And one way of doing that, I think, is allowing an applicant to respond and having a process in place where the objector gets investigated a little bit thoroughly, or even just a little bit. I think you're all pretty familiar with the case with Doug Gay, where a person pretended to represent an organization and filed an objection, and yet the process protected that person, forcing us into responding to that objection almost, because they didn't actually represent the organization. And so there needs to be a process in place that the applicant can respond to the objection and bring to light the fact that it is potentially a fake objection or unwarranted in some respect. It doesn't currently exist a process, and it seemed that ICANN and even the ICANN board struggled with how they were going to deal with this because there wasn't a process in place for them to address it as easily as, you know, buying time and sort of trying to figure it out. And in the end, it forced us to get that organization that was misrepresented to actually have to write a letter to ICANN to try to finally put an end to it, which is what we were forced to do. If there was a process that in place where somebody had to just do a quick check and make sure that that organization truly was represented by that person filing the objection, all of it could have been prevented, and it would have cost a lot less time and a lot less money for everybody. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. Tahani, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Robin. Tijani speaking. I think that for the community application as well as the community objection, we need first to define well what is the community, even if I think that the applicant guidebook defined it more or less good. But unfortunately, in the first round, some of the community applications that satisfied the applicant guidebook didn't satisfy the panel, and we had several of them rejected by the panel. So something very important is to make more objective criteria for the community definition. Thank you.
Thanks, and really appreciate all the really good feedback we're getting today on some of these viewpoints. Anyone else want to weigh in on the community application objection process? I note in the chat, Christina says, we should consider making the requirement Jamie suggests applicable to all objections. If it makes sense to apply to community objections, it should also make sense to apply to the other three. To be clear, not advocating on the merits, but the scope. Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on the objections? Have some other suggestions for improvements for the next round, should it be called a round? Okay, yes, Anne, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Robin and Sam. I just noted that on these community objections that a lot of issues were raised about the expense involved with the ICC, and to the point, you know, where the ICC then issued an explanatory memo as to how they calculate their costs. And I think this issue of cost in this type of objection is an ongoing concern for the next round. I don't know whether it means that we should be considering other places for community objections to be for deliberations on those or what, but I think there were several folks who commented that the ICC fees were quite high.
Thanks very much, Ann. Okay, anyone else want to weigh in on objections with respect to community? Okay, I don't see any other hands or hear any other voices, so let's go on to the next set of slides, objections that deal with the independent objector. Okay, some of the questions that have preliminarily been discussed by the work team, was the intent of the independent objector met in the 2012 round? Did the IO act within his remit? I think there was a bit of skepticism that it had, or he did. Are changes needed to the criteria under which IO could bring an objection? Again, this would be a great place with specifics for how, what changes are needed. How to prevent real or perceived conflicts of interest? Should there be a structure for penalizing multiple frivolous objections? Was the independent objector cost effective in the 2012 round? I know we've had a lot of discussion on that point. Would a standing panel yield better results than an independent objector? There seem to be a lot of people taking the view that that might be a better approach next time. Could changes to the existing objections mechanisms serve the need currently filled by the independent objector? And last but not least, is the independent objector role even warranted in subsequent procedures? So we've got a lot of questions here, and I had a good bit of preliminary discussion with respect to the independent objector. So what do folks think of, you know, where we are now? Who's got views on recommendations for improvements with respect to the independent objector process? Do folks agree, for example, that a standing panel would yield better results than the individual? Yes, Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm really questioning whether the term standing panel is the right term. I think what we're talking about here is that instead of having a single independent objector, we have perhaps a group of three, and presumably two out of the three have to decide to file an objection. Panel implies, at least to me anyway, that they a group to whom things are brought, and I don't think that is what we're talking about here. Clearly, three people would be more expensive than one. On the other hand, judicious thought behind it may well reduce the number of objections significantly. So I would strongly support a small group instead of a single objector.
Thanks very much, Alan. Anyone else have any views on this, whether we call it a panel or a small group? I think the point is taken that it could produce better results than what we tried last time. Okay. I see Christina has typed in the chat, having multiple independent objectors could potentially address the conflict of interest issue. And she says we absolutely need a conflict of interest mechanism. With respect to the independent objector, the applicant should have an opportunity to have the conflict of interest issue addressed before having to submit a substantive response. Yeah, I think this is something in particular that has come up before, and so I'd be very curious if what others think. Can we take this forward? Susan Payne types, I think the idea of a standing panel was to address conflicts. If there are alternatives, if one independent objector is conflicted. Okay, and Christina weighs in. Perhaps there's an initial process, sort of like a quick look, but needs to be substantive that could be adopted. Yep, that's a helpful suggestion. Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Anne, please come in.
Yes, thanks, Robin. It's Anne. I again wanted to talk about coordinating efforts in the sense that I think that there were some recommendations coming out of Workstream 2 in relation to the independent objector. I mean, people will correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some discussion. I certainly want to echo the comments of those who talk about trying to screen for conflict of interest and how having more than one IO is a good idea in terms of that screening for conflict of interest. But I also think that there needs to be some coordination, I believe, and maybe Cheryl's knowledgeable on this or others on the call about what's going on in Workstream 2 accountability in relation to the independent objector. Thanks.
Thanks, Anne. Anybody else want to get in on independent objector? And I have to apologize, I've got a fire truck going past now. What about the overall question? Is the independent objector role even warranted in subsequent procedures? You know, it was sort of a we were trying out a concept the first time, and is it worth doing again? Was it a good idea? What do folks think on that? Or another way to ask a similar but slightly different question is, was the independent objector process cost effective? Did it produce the kind of bang for its buck that warranted its paying for it in the first place? I know then we had a lot of concern that it just was very, very expensive considering the results that came out of it. Anybody have any views on the cost effectiveness of independent objector process, or if the process is even warranted in subsequent procedures? Yes, Karen's got her hand up. Please, Karen, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This isn't to speak to the cost, but more to a previous point that was made, and I think Christina alluded to in her question with regard to do we know if the IO filed and won any objections that couldn't have been won on any other grounds? She says this seems to be the question we need to answer before deciding if we still need an independent objector. And while I don't have an answer to that specific question, what that question reminded me of is a discussion that we had at, I believe it was in Copenhagen, meeting when we discussed the independent objector. The rationale that was presented at that time for having the independent objector originally was that in 2012 and prior, when this program was established, the feeling was that the community and the world in general wasn't mature enough and aware enough of the GTLDs to be on the lookout for what to object to. And so that's why the independent objector was put into place to sort of be the eyes and the ears of the world while they were learning about what new GTLDs are, and that at some future point, the independent objector may not be needed if the community or the world in general has matured enough and understands enough that they can look out for themselves, and they may not need the independent objector to, in essence, babysit for them. But the counter argument was raised that, yes, while we have all matured, we all know more about GTLDs and are more aware, there are still economies in the world and portions of the world which we have an obligation to look out for that aren't yet up to the same standards and speeds that we are. So it wasn't an aspect so much of the independent objector winning arguments that other people couldn't win. It was just the fact that they were engaged full-time, whereas the rest of the world probably wasn't so much engaged. So I just wanted to sort of refresh on that conversation that was from Copenhagen. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen. That's really helpful background on how this process, why it was created in the first place, this particular independent objector process. All right, next in the queue is Anne. Anne, please go ahead.
Yes, just very quickly, Robin, I think the other aspect of independent objector is just the cost of filing an objection and the notion that there may be a good reason for an objection, such as a limited public interest objection, but that those who are concerned about the issue, you know, the wider internet user community generally may not have either necessarily the organization or the funds to file an objection. And so it's not really a question of whether the objection is otherwise winnable, because there's a question of resources. And I do agree with Cheryl's comment in the chat that there's still a question of awareness. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Independent objector, any other thoughts on coalescing some of our initial recommendations here where we think we can find some agreement within our group? Anne, is that a new hand or an old hand? I'm sorry. Looks like an old hand. Okay. Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on some of these views and or something that's missing from this slide? What's missing? Okay, well, I don't see or hear any other thoughts on the independent objector. So let's move on to the next issue on the agenda, which is applicant freedom of expression. So we're really switching gears here away from objections and deliberating instead on the applicant freedom of expression policy goal. So we're on slide 9. Is that 9? Maybe that's 10. We're on slide 10. So back in 2007, when we came up with the new GTLD policy recommendations that were approved by the GNSO Council and then went on to be approved by the ICANN Board of Directors, there was policy principle G that said the string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights that are protected under internationally recognized principles of law. So this was a policy goal that we came up with, but didn't get very far in its implementation down the line. And that was something that I think we've talked about before as being perhaps an oversight or just something that we need to tighten down a little bit better for the next round. So really trying to make sure that implementation guidance next time would be included in an applicant guidebook that informs applicants and panelists and others of the existence of this recommendation and the policy goal of fostering freedom of expression in generic top-level domains. So one of the questions that we have is, how do we balance protection for applicant freedom of expression rights with governments or other pressures to restrict the use of words in TLDs that might be lawful speech, but there are forces that want to restrict it for reasons despite that aren't legal reasons, but they feel sensitive or offended or something that doesn't quite reach the level of a legal restriction, but nonetheless, ICANN is a place to go to try to enforce those kinds of restrictions in the top-level domain space. So So how can we come up with some kind of a implementation guidance that reminds the applicants, reminds the panelists, reminds the world at large that this is an important policy goal that we share at ICANN, and it's part of the new GTLD policy, but we need to make sure that it gets remembered when it comes to panelist decisions and other types of dispute resolution processes down the line. So let me just stop there and open it up. Anyone have any suggestions on this point or thoughts on this issue, applicant freedom of expression and how to ensure that gets protected in the next round? Okay, I don't see or hear anyone. We do have about 8 minutes left in our meeting, and I would like to get some feedback on this point. So if anyone's got any thoughts on applicant freedom of expression and how it can be better handled in the next round, please do weigh in now because we need feedback from the community. Okay, I see Tijani's got his hand up. Please, go.
Thank you very much, Robin. Tijani speaking. Do you mean that any word should be accepted, even if it is expressing, for example, hate or something like this?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question? I couldn't quite.
I said that you are speaking about pressure from government or elsewhere restricting the use of words. Do you mean that any word should be accepted, even if it is expressing hate or something like this?
I don't think that anyone has taken that position. I think the sort of the baseline is that what is lawful speech is permitted. And if speech is unlawful, then it isn't permitted, even in TLDs. So I don't think anyone's taking that position. The question is, how do we balance the legitimate interests on different sides to come up with a policy proposal that's fair to everyone and still meets the goals, the new GTLD policy principle, G, which says freedom of expression will be protected at the top level. Okay, I see in the chat, Anne says, could you talk a little bit about how this was mishandled in the 2012 round? Okay, I think the issue is really that the implementation guidance didn't quite make it into... There was no implementation guidance on this in the draft applicant guidebook. So, you know, you look at all of the other recommendations that we came up with on council. For example, we were talking before about recommendation 6 that said, everything has to be moral and doesn't conflict with public order type deal. So that was an objection that came out of that particular recommendation. So, it went into the guidebook. It was further delineated. There were processes and procedures that were put in place to make sure that that policy goal was, in fact, able to be exercised in the subsequent process. So I think the issue here is that this one was just sort of left on the table and never actually made its way into implementation guidance. And so there was some concern that there were some objections made that had there been this policy proposal implemented, wouldn't have been able to go forward as strongly as had it in fact been implemented. I think that's just one idea. I'd be curious to hear what others think on this topic. Okay, I see Jamie has his hand up. Please, Jamie, go ahead.
Thanks. Jamie Baxter for the record. I think perhaps sharing a little bit about our experience might open up some dialogue. Very early on, it was brought to our attention that there could be some pushback and concern about the word that we chose for a TLD from the community, especially from certain governments. And, of course, that is exactly what happened. It seems as though the policy that was in place, in fact, worked as we expected it to, in ensuring that gay was not a word that would be rejected. Looking at society today and some of the political maneuvering that's going on, I certainly have more anxiety today over somebody trying to block or stop or prevent an application for a word like gay than I perhaps did 8 years ago. And so not having clear guidance or understanding about how that part of the process is going to be managed, I think would probably raise more concern and alarms with me today than it did then. So I'm not sure where I sit on this, but I think having more guidance as to, you know, where freedom of expression sort of ends and where it starts is probably going to be important for somebody, I would expect.
Thanks very much, Jamie. Does anyone else want to weigh in on this point, applicant freedom of expression? Okay, I don't see or hear one, and we've got about 1 minute left in our meeting. Oh, I see Alan's got his hand up. Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, just a very quick comment. This is not going to be an area that we're going to come to a definitive, perfect answer on. One person's freedom of expression is someone else's offensive comment or someone else's, we are going to be at loggerheads on this one, and we're not going to fix it. As Jamie said, the world is getting more complex in this area, not simpler. So I think, we put the words in, and then we will have dramas play out as we go forward. I don't think we can avoid it. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And with that, you will have the last word on the topic, right at the top of the hour. So let me just quickly go on. Is there any other business anybody else wanted to bring up before we bring this meeting to a conclusion? I note that our next meeting is set for February 13th at 1500 UTC, and I see Karen's got her hand up. Please, Karen, go ahead.
Hi, yes, very quickly, I just wanted to remind folks that we are still having our continued discussion on the email list with regard to the legal rights objection and the string confusion objection. So we're going to give those discussions another week and a half or so, and then we'll start trying to summarize and write up some coalescence or lack thereof positions on those two issues. So any final thoughts and on those two subjects, please send them out to the email list, and we appreciate your input. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen. And our next meeting on the 13th, the topics that are on our agenda are accountability mechanisms and string similarity. So I know you're all going to be in stitches waiting for that one. Anyways, thank you all very much for a great meeting. I do appreciate it. I know this is a very busy for folks, and let's continue this discussion online. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Meeting has been adjourned.
Thank you. Bye-bye.